government is not our master, it is our servant. Its only power, that which we the people allow it to have.
Liberty Watch is an independent program on KVOI dedicated to the notion that government remains servant, not master, and operating in the public interest for which the media in this country was designed, by exploring controversy. This helps us to resolve our differences peaceably, refining controversy into clarity through investigation, research, interview of experts, and public feedback. Liberty Watch is based in objective reason and is biased towards individual liberty, and so is not the view of the station or anyone but the host, guests, and callers. Liberty Watch operates outside the realm of political correctness, taking no notice at all of race, creed, religion, ethnicity, political affiliation, or orientation, focusing on content of character in eternal vigilance for the free flow of information about government, technology, current events, and our steadfast Constitution. The program is paid, produced, hosted, and operated by Charles Heller, and any mistakes are solely his responsibility.
And welcome to Liberty Watch, where we focus on the notion that government remains servant, not master. To that end, there's a fantastic book out there about the 1619 Project by Philip W. Magnus, who is at the Independent Institute, formerly senior research and faculty and F.A. Hayek Chair in Economics and Economic History at the American Institute for Economic Research, and he has a Ph.D. from George Mason University's School of Public Policy and a B.A. from the University of St. Thomas in Houston, and he spent over a decade teaching public policy, economics, and international trade at institutions including American University, George Mason, and Berry College, and his work encompasses the economic history of the United States. Philip Magnus, welcome for the first time to the microphones and telephones of Liberty Watch.
Thanks for having me.
How do you prefer to be addressed? Dr. Magnus, Professor? Phil?
Phil is fine.
Yeah, it's good.
Keep it informal.
My father, I can still hear the echoes of him yelling at me when I didn't address people by their proper title. That, you know, and it's so drilled into me by Master Sergeant Heller that I I always have a tendency to ask. You know, we are the product of both our environment and who we are genetically and what we grow up around, or what I lovingly refer to as our freight damage. So on Foundation, what form of abuse induced stress causes someone to grow up interested in economic history? What were the factors that made you that way?
Well, I've always had an empirical direction to my research interests, but I also like looking at the past. And, to me, the past is a collection of data points. It's a collection of evidence. It's also a little bit removed from the politics of the current day. So I've always liked the ability to view things in retrospect rather than jumping into the political fray of the moment.
So in essence, the study of that type of economic history is something of a sanctuary for you?
In a way, I'd say, yeah. It's
that's insightful. I don't think I've heard it put that way before. That's kind of an interesting insight into who you are. Do you like, I'm going off the track here, but frankly, sometimes what develops out of an interview is more interesting than the questions I wrote down anyway.
Sure.
Do you love going to, like, Gettysburg and other historical sites, or is it mostly the study of the history rather than the action?
It's a little bit of both. When I do travel, I often try to see the local historical site, even if it's outside of my direct area of interest or expertise, because it gives a glimpse into, how a society developed, what shaped the history of a location or place.
Can you think of a time when an adjacency like that changed the way you thought?
I would say more providing context to the way that I thought. You know, actually seeing something in person shows a different angle than what you read by just looking at it in a book. So quite a few historical sites are like that, just being able to stand there and see the landscape, see the physical location, things start to make sense more.
I went on a cruise down the Mississippi River, a steamboat cruise, on a paddle wheeler, the Delta Queen. I went on a number of years ago, and one of the stops they made, a steamboat landing stop, was at an antebellum Southern mansion, and I looked at the slave quarters, and it changed me.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And to actually physically see the space there, it impresses upon you.
They made the kitchen separate from the house because there were a lot of fires in kitchens.
Right.
And they put it near the slave quarters because they didn't care if the slaves burned as much as the house. And I just...
Yeah.
All right. Down to this. Please tell us what the 1619 Project is and who are its authors. Give us a context.
The 1619 Project started as a special issue of the New York Times in 2019, and it was organized by Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's a longtime writer for the Times, basically as a way to investigate the history and legacy of slavery in the United States. And they picked 1619 because that's the year that the first slave ship arrives off the coast of Jamestown, Virginia. It's the origin point of what essentially becomes slavery in the British colonies. Florida and other parts of the South that were under Spanish control had slavery dating back almost a century prior to that. But she was focused on the British American colonies and really the legacy of what came out of Jamestown. And, you know, on its surface, that's a valuable and interesting historical subject to investigate. And I was originally excited when I saw it that morning in the New York Times. But when I began to read it, I started to see very clear evidence that there was a political agenda undergirding the entire project. It was less an investigation of the past, more of an attempt to enlist the past as evidence for a political argument she was making in the present day. Mm. And a lot of those arguments ended up being very left-wing in their direction, advocating for massive government intervention in the economy, redistribution of wealth, tearing down capitalism, things like that. Mm. And I saw that immediately as just a misuse of the past. Although other elements of the 1619 Project had some value to them, so I had kind of a mixed initial reaction to it, but nonetheless, the problems started to emerge pretty early on, and they included bending the truth, manipulating evidence, misstating fact in order to prop up this modern-day political agenda.
Hmm. Does Nicole Hannah-Jones appear to write as if she had her master's in mendacity or a Ph.D. in prevarication?
That's the great question here. I mean, she is very much an editorial writer, although she has kind of misrepresented her aim in this project based on the occasion. And it's almost become a joke about the 1619 Project. Whenever it is under scrutiny by historians for factual inaccuracies, she seems to retreat into this line and say, oh, well, it's just editorial journalism. We can have a little bit of fudge room with the facts because we're making an editorial point. And then a minute later, she'll turn around and say, well, this is actually an untold part of history that needs to be in the classroom.
Wait. So hold on a second. I want to call you on a term. Editorial. You're saying, you're quoting her. I understand you didn't make it up. Editorial.
She tweeted this out.
Editorial journalism. Isn't that like chaste fornication? I mean, isn't it somewhat of a collision at the corner of common and sense to say editorial journalism?
Yes. And there's the contradiction. I mean, there are all sorts of euphemisms and playing word games to really obscure what the purpose is here. So what it does is it creates a moving target for the critics that if you pin it down on a factual error, she moves into some other line of attack or line of argument, which basically says, well, I'm engaged in editorializing, so therefore you can't hold me to the same standards that you would if a Ph.D. historian made some of the same claims and understandably became scrutinized.
You know, I had this happen to me when I got interviewed locally by the Arizona Daily Star. And I recorded the interview because the... alleged journalist actually quoted me as saying things that she just plain made up.
Yeah.
I never said and I never intended. And I complained to the editorial department and they said, well, she was paraphrasing you. I said, no, I wasn't. No, she wasn't. She was changing the meaning of what I said. She claimed I said that people's ability to get guns was more important than whether or not they committed suicide, which I would never say and never think. But she said, well, she was paraphrasing the idea that you don't, when you don't impair people's rights because some people may do harm, that's what you really meant.
Well, you've seen the exact same pattern in the 1619 Project. I mean, I had that essentially happen to me in my attempts to get facts corrected by the New York Times. Noticed a historical error where one of the writers had misrepresented a source that he was paraphrasing from. And I contacted the editor of the New York Times and said, here's the original passage from the book he's paraphrasing. Here's what he says. They're the exact opposite. And the editor just kind of brushes me off and says, well, that's just a difference of interpretation. We view it this way. You view it a different way. And I'm saying, no, this is actually a factual claim here.
Right. This is not semantical. It's substantive.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I get that sometimes in communications with people that don't, you know, don't hold accuracy as the highest value, which I understand. You know, not everybody is an articulate communicator, and maybe they're good at something else. But when you're alleged that you're a journalist, you might think it's a, you know, I interviewed a guy one time. I said he was talking about the use of military contractors, you know, in essence, mercenaries. Right.
Yeah.
And I said to him, well, that's why it's in the Constitution. And he laughed. And I said, why are you laughing? He goes, you say it's in the Constitution. And I go, yeah, because it is in the Constitution. He goes, oh, I'm not familiar. I said, I thought you were a journalist.
Yeah.
And he says, yeah. Well, yeah, I am. David, I'll think of his last name in a minute. And I said, letters of mark and reprisal. What do you think
exactly.
that means? Some guys are just sailing on the USS Clueless.
Right.
And, oh, well, I digress.
And it's a theme. You know, one of the major points that I make in the book is a lot of the defects of the 1619 Project don't come from intentional manipulation so much as they come from incompetence. Nicole Hannah-Jones herself and a lot of the writers that she recruited simply didn't know what they were talking about. You know, you think if you're going to do this major journalistic initiative on the history of slavery, you'd try to at least get a couple experts on the American Revolution and the Civil War and that whole period in between where slavery is kind of the pinnacle of its political power. And yet she doesn't do that. Instead, she finds other journalists or she takes it on herself. Or the one that I really critique is Matthew Desmond. It's the author she recruits to write about the economics of slavery. And he's a sociology professor from Princeton who, as far as I can tell, had never even written on this subject before. He started taking it up for the 1619 Project. So a lot of the errors come about because he's just way out of his league, doesn't know what he's talking about, and therefore defaults to projecting this far-left kind of Marxian politics into his interpretation.
Hmm. Projection. You know, if you want to editorialize in a journalistic piece, just quote somebody who believes what you think and quote them and then give some kind of a counter-argument. And if you deliberately do a weak counter-argument to it, that's a way of biased journalism, but it's honest.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. You're at least attributing it to someone else who can be held accountable for their views
right.
and their arguments that they're making.
Right. And you can say, well, it's journalistic framing bias that I quoted this particular one and that particular one, but that's a different argument. That journalistic framing bias, what the Society for Professional Journalists refers to as a framing bias, it's one thing to do that. It's another to insert your opinion. All right. Stand by, Philip. We'll be right back. We've got about a three-minute break here, and we'll be right back with Philip W. Magnus and his excellent book about the 1619 Project. Swap shop trains are coming, rolling down that free market track. Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the swap shop. Let's listen. Do you know what the record length is for the catch of the infamous Pima sand shark?
No, I do not.
I don't either. I just figured you might know.
That's a good trivia question. I think I'll look that up.
You're right. I know that the biggest one was in the Rio, but anyway. Swap shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
Hi, it's Mark Levin. Liberty Watch on KVOI is dedicated to the notion that government remains servant, not master. Sounds like Charles has been reading my books. Congratulations on KVOI, Charles.
Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom.
Over me,
and before I be a slave,
to Liberty Watch. We have the joy and pleasure of having Philip W. Magnus, and he's got a phenomenal book. It's actually a reissue or a second edition, the Project 1619 Myth. Philip, where do you want people to be able to get the book?
So we have it in all of the major online sellers like Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and then also some local bookstores. We've actually just put it out. So I would encourage people, you know, to check it out online. You can go to independent.org, our website as well, and we have a bookstore. Occasionally we put up discounts and stuff for holidays and things like that.
So independent.org.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I'm using music deliberately from what they refer to, not my term, as Negro spirituals music that is done by various groups over the years, songs that had come from the era of slavery. And the right. idea is Nicole Hannah-Jones is the chief cook and bottle washer of this 1619 project, in which you said, quote, "Enlisting history for political editorializing is a time-honored habit of commentators across the political spectrum. So in a sense, the 1619 Project's indulgences in the same were unexceptional. The Times branding, however, exhibited a schizophrenia of purposes," unquote. What is that so-called schizophrenia? That was your term, by the way. What is that so-called, I want to make sure I attribute things properly on this program.
Sure.
What is that so-called schizophrenia of purposes?
Well, it's what the 1619 Project is really up to, because if you look at the way the New York Times packaged it, it came out with this massive educational marketing campaign. They built a curriculum to put it into the K-12 classroom. They later extended that into a book-length version of it, a Hulu docuseries that had lesson plans attached to it and pre-made so they could show this again in the classroom. So it's being presented on the one hand as this very reliable educational tool and resource that authors contributed to in ways that reflected scholarship, reflected standard of best practices in the history profession. And the idea here is that this is a reliable telling of American history that could be used in the classroom. So that's one half of the schizophrenia. The other half is that you have all these political claims that are made throughout the book and throughout the Hulu series about how we aren't really just investigating slavery in the past as a historical topic, we're also trying to bring about reform in the present day. And Nicole Hannah-Jones, as well as several of her co-authors, they give some specific prescriptions that they want. So they want slavery reparations to the tune of $13 trillion paid out by the U.S. government to descendants of slaves. They also want things that look a lot like the Green New Deal and a Democratic Party platform, at least the far left wing of the Democratic Party, in 2020, 2025. And yet they're saying that this is an extension of the past, that we need to engage in these political reforms today to make amends for the horrors of slavery that they claim that they have set out on this neutral, scholarly, educational platform that they put together.
I kind of like what John Roberts said in one of the recent decisions against discrimination. I think it was the one about Harvard admissions, when he said, if you want to stop discrimination, all you have to do is stop discriminating.
Right, right.
It's like, which is remarkably clear for a Supreme Court justice to say.
Yes. Ignore, they equivocate.
Yeah. My father, one of the last things he watched on television in 2005 was the hearings, the confirmation hearings for Roberts. And he goes, he looked at me, and my dad was a lifelong FDR Democrat and a true liberal, not a leftist, and a civil libertarian. And he said, I don't agree with this guy's philosophy, but man, is he magnificent.
Yeah. Yeah.
We talked about judges calling balls and strikes.
And you can respect that even if you disagree with the position that they come to.
That used to be the America we lived in. I'm sorry I stepped on you. What were you saying?
No worries. Yeah, it's the same thing I would say of historians, professional historians. Many of them come from the left, so the majority of the profession. It's like all of academia is on the left. But if they make a solid argument and they bring evidence to bear, I can respect that and I can cite that work, and I hope that they would do the same with my work coming from a different perspective. It's when they actually become hackish and overly political is the problem.
Well, the problem is that a lot of historians become hysterians.
Yes. Yeah.
And
we saw that with the 1619 Project in many, many ways.
What it is it's the upset industrial complex. It's the idea of selling upsetism. And the model is the same. You can just change the issue. The same is done with climate. The same is done with slavery reparations. It's done in ways because it comes right out of Saul Alinsky, Rules with Radicals. You can't get any change unless people are upset.
Well, that's exactly it. They're selling grievances and they're selling points of agitation. Whether or not it's factually sound becomes entirely a secondary point. And we saw that in some of the fallout of the 1619 projects. You know, initially, this thing is pilloried across the political spectrum by actual historians. They look into the data. They look into the claims that are being made. They point out this is a factual error. You cannot assert that the American Revolution was fought over slavery because the evidence just is not there for that point. And I made that argument. Historians on the left, even the World Socialist website weighed in as a critic of it on some of the many of the same points that I was arguing and other middle of the road historians were arguing. But that kind of gave way over the next year or so to the activist wing of academia and the history profession. They decided that the 1619 project was something that needed to be treated as sacrosanct. It was the new messaging on the left, and any factual scrutiny of it became subordinated to the political message of we need to uphold this because otherwise we're giving in to Donald Trump was basically the argument that several of them made.
Well, it's an argument that's it's refined into one word, racism. All right,
yes.
Real briefly, because we're up on a break, we're actually over for it, but I want to get to this because I want to get my questions in. What is the so-called NHC or New History of Capitalism? Just real briefly, what is that?
Yeah, so it's a school within the history profession. It emerged in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. And basically what they said is we as historians need to be investigating the history of capitalism for the first time ever. They basically said we have a novel take. No one's ever investigated this, even though it's one of the most heavily plowed areas of economic history. And then they put forth a reinterpretation of the entirety of not only worldwide, but specifically American industrialization that says slavery is the centerpiece of what made America a rich country.
I tell you, if you want to investigate that, just read Ludwig von Mises. All right.
Exactly.
Stand by. And Philip W. Magnus is the guest. His book is The 1619 Project Myth.
Thank you for listening to Liberty Watch.
Swap shop trains coming, rolling down that free market track.
Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the swap shop. Let's listen.
I was looking around for one of these tiny little vacuum cleaners that operates by itself. And what did I find? There are cameras in there, and the images are sent to places unknown.
Maybe there's a Chinese bathroom live cam site.
Don't clean the house in the nude.
Swap shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
Hi, it's Dennis Prager. Liberty Watch is dedicated to the notion that government remain servant, not master. Goes very well with my concept of E Pluribus Unum Liberty and in God We Trust. Congratulations, Charles.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn.
And welcome back to Liberty Watch, where we have the joy and pleasure of having with us Philip W. Magnus of the Independent Institute. His phenomenal book in second edition is The 1619 Project Myth. I've read most of it, not quite all of it, but I think there were four chapters. There's two chapters I missed. But anyway, it's a phenomenal work. It's worth your time because it's a logical laying out of the case about why there's an awful lot of prevarication and mendacity in the 1619 project. Now, you said that, let me see if I can find it here. In what you state is, quote, the worthy historical task of documenting the horrors of American slavery. It's been cynically repurposed into an ideological attack on free market capitalism. How so, Phil Magnus?
Well, this is the other thing people should understand about the 1619 Project. Even though it says it's first and foremost about slavery, that's not the real objective here. It's about using slavery to forward an ideological attack. And this comes about in two ways. So Nicole Hannah-Jones sets it up in her initial overview essay, her first chapter, where she basically says America is built on the backs of slavery, down to its founding era, all the way through to its economics. And then she follows that up. There's this essay by Matthew Desmond on slavery and capitalism that allegedly shows that U.S. industry and U.S. wealth in the 19th century derives from slave production. Therefore, it's exploitative. Therefore, wealth today is tainted. And then Nicole Hannah-Jones comes full circle on that, says, well, basically in her conclusion, we therefore need $13 trillion in government-funded slave reparations, as well as a massive social agenda to rewrite and alter and basically abolish American capitalism. And you see this in several of the arguments in the Hulu series today. She's not ranting so much against the problem of slavery historically. It's about claiming that Amazon.com distribution centers are like descendants of plantation, or that Microsoft Excel is derivative of plantation accounting books, which is another of these crazy claims that are made in the 1619 Project. So it's all about overthrowing the economy that we have today in the supposed name of making recompensation for this historical sin.
So that, in other words, capitalism is derivative of slavery. So what is capitalism, or as I prefer to refer to, I dislike the term capitalism because it was coined by Marx. So, but I prefer to call it free market economic system. What is the free market economic system's historical view of slavery?
Well, you can go back to Adam Smith himself. You read in The Wealth of Nations, he does not have nice things to say about the slave system that existed across the Atlantic in the colonies at the time. In many ways, Smith himself is basically an abolitionist. So the founding father of capitalism is personally an abolitionist, and he works that into his economic articulations of what we know as capitalism today, and yet they pretend as if this is somehow like the origin point or the mechanism of slavery. It's just a complete inversion of history.
Yeah, Smith, if you read him, spends a lot of energy explaining the price of labor.
Exactly, exactly, and laying out that free labor works better.
Say again?
Lays out that free labor is a superior system to slavery.
Oh, in other words, people being free with their labor. Okay.
Exactly.
As opposed to the free labor of slavery. I see what you're saying there. Chris, you're on the radio with Philip W. Magnus of the book The 1619 Project Myth. Your comment or question for Mr. Magnus?
First, great topic. It's good to have a Dr. Phil, if I could call you that, that I actually like.
Fair enough.
I like the cut of your jib, bud. I like what you're saying. I just had a comment. I feel the new scarlet letter that starts with an A should be activism. There should be warning labels. There should be warnings. It's just pretty much the editorial is taken over, and it's activism. And then my other comment is, I find it so ironic that they're going back in time and distorting the history of slavery and tearing down our country, where we might actually be able to lead and end slavery, because the last time I checked, slavery is more predominant now than it's ever been in our history. And they're back, I won't say the B word, and they're back complaining and distorting history back then when they could be combating what's going on now. And I'll take your reply off the air.
Okay.
Absolutely. So the point is absolutely true about activism having come to supplant scholarship, because there is good, rigorous historical scholarship that can be done in a way that's not advancing a political agenda. But what you keep finding, and this is true not only of historians, but a large swath of the academic profession, as they've moved leftward, and it's empirically demonstrable over the past 20 to 30 years, academia shifted from kind of a slightly left of center to now it's a 60-65% majority of faculty on all disciplines that identify on the political left. And as that has happened, there's been a decline in scholarly rigor, and you have surveys of professors. You ask them, like, what's your purpose in the classroom? And one answer that has grown and grown and grown over the years is to instill activism, to instill social justice in my students. That did not used to be the case. It used to be the pursuit of truth was the mechanism and purpose of higher education, and to teach people how to think critically. Now it's to teach them to become activists to change the world, but they only really mean that in one direction. It's a left-leaning direction. So you absolutely have that there. The 1619 Project's a manifestation of it. So there's plenty of evidence that the left-wing trajectory of the Academy has filtered into popular media. So I view this as just like a culmination of that pattern. Now, on the question of slavery in the world today,
if I may, before you go there, and that is academic rigor has become academic rigor mortis.
That is fair. Sadly, that is the state of things.
And that's
why you see a decline in public confidence in the university system. They've done it to themselves.
Right. All right. You were going to say about activism.
And then the notion that, yes, slavery is a problem in many parts of the world today, and that was not thoroughly investigated by the 1619 Project. It tries to pin the history of this horrendous worldwide institution. It's gone back to biblical times. It's gone back in every major society on earth to the dawn of time has had some experience with slavery. It happened in the Old World. It happened among the native tribes in the New World.
Mm-hmm.
It's a human condition that was inherited from antiquity and operated in very brutal ways. But the big part of the story that's left out, that's written out, is how did we finally overturn this system and throw it off after thousands of years? And that's part of the American story, too. And really one of the counterpoints I make is that the American founding causes a philosophical and moral reckoning with slavery that persists through the Civil War. It's not always the dominant position, but it is certainly there, and it's putting pressure against the slave system of the South. And what you really start to see is right after the American Revolution, people are recognizing the inconsistency of these articulated principles of freedom with the persistence of the slave system. So starting in 1777, Vermont, which is the first new colony in addition to the original 13, the new state, they adopt the first constitution in the Western world that explicitly prohibits slavery. And they do so because it's inconsistent with the principles of liberty that they were fighting for in the American Revolution. And this continues across all of the former northern colonies within the course of about a decade and a half have abolished slavery in their borders. And that's, again, a derivative of the principles of the American founding. And I say, yes, we want to investigate the horrors of slavery, but also tell that story as well of what actually brought us to the point that we could overthrow and end this horrendous system, because that's an important part of the American legacy itself.
If you don't have the patience to read a book, go watch the movie Amistad.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely.
I love that line about you can report to the president that slavery no longer exists on this coast after they bombed the fort that was bombarded the fort that was guarding slaves.
That's exactly. There's a whole history here of people fighting for moral and economic and plenty of other reasons that slavery is repugnant and taking steps and putting their own lives on the line to end this institution.
Yep, that's right. And the work of William Wilberforce.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
There's a wonderful book called Wilberforce. And was it Eric Metaxas that wrote that?
I'd have to check, but I think that sounds about right.
Yeah, that's right. He writes some really long books.
Right.
But they're so good. I've wanted to have him on for so long. I don't think he's going to do any media on Sunday. He's a pretty devout Christian. All right. So I had a number of things I wanted to get to, but we're at a break, so let's go ahead and take that break. Yeah.
Swap Shop trains coming. Rolling down
Sunday morning, 10 to 11 a.m. on KVOI. You can buy and sell and trade anything you want that's lawful and moral to own. Let's listen.
Rick, you're on the Swap Shop.
Hovercraft is like on Star Wars, but it's missing engine.
Yeah.
Easy, Chewy.
It's got its own trailer. My number is 272.
Swap Shop, Sundays, 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
Electricity, yeah, you can all thank me. Took some lightning and kite and a
bat. All right, let's get right back to the interview. We've got a call holding for Philip Magnus of the book, The 1619 Project. He's with the Independent Institute, and we're going to go to Bunker. You're live on the air with Philip Magnus. Go ahead.
Dr. Philip, I have a question for you, and that is concerning the rigidity of religion and how it plays into slavery, and maybe using Jamestown as a jumping-off point for America.
Absolutely. So Jamestown, you know, it's the first successful British colony. And in 1619, there is a ship that arrives off the shore, and they basically land a small group of captured African Americans that had been seized from another ship. It's basically like pirates or privateers had seized a cargo of slaves from Africa, and then they come and sell them to the British colony. But when they, at the time that this occurs, the legal status of those persons is very ambiguous. There's no code in Virginia that says slavery exists, but there are inherited indentured servitudes that had previously been coming over to the colony. So these people are landed in Jamestown. They don't really know their full legal status until a generation or two later that you actually start to get some of the codes. And one of the interpretations is that these are people that are indentured for life, but their children are free. And some of the original slaves that are landed there, that basically happens. Others acquire their freedom during their lifetimes. It's not until 1662 that Virginia's colonial assembly basically puts in a law that says there is a color line attached to slavery, and it comes through the descent from the mother. If your mother was a slave, you are also born into slavery, and they establish that with black people to differentiate it from white indentured servants and also Native Americans that had been enslaved or forced into labor. So it's that codification much, much later that establishes this institution of slavery.
The religious leaders there were pretty much ambiguous to slavery.
And it's a part of history that we have to recognize. Our moral reckoning with slavery today reflects developments that occurred in the intervening years. I mean, it's really not until the late 1700s that you start to get a very clear, coherent movement that articulates the moral wrong of slavery in the modern sense. And that, again, it's intertwined with the principles of liberty that come about from the American Revolution. There's also an Enlightenment philosophy that's sweeping across Europe. Adam Smith's a part of that discussion. But people that are coming to a moral reckoning with slavery by, for the first time in a systematic way, questioning why this institution that's been around for thousands of years exists and pointing out, wait a minute, it's wrong and we should take proactive steps to end it.
Great question, Bunker. Appreciate the contribution. Phil Magnus, why does the 1619 Project so totally ignore economics?
Well, it's because they don't know what they're talking about. They didn't consult any economists. They used, again, this Matthew Desmond character who just did not have the qualifications to understand it. So what he does is he supplants that with his own political beliefs and ideology. And again, this is someone coming from kind of a Marxian socialist far left. And when you don't understand the economics, you just insert that into its place and proceed as if it's true.
Yeah, projection.
And this is one of the major errors. Exactly. It's projecting their own ideology onto the past.
I suspect that there's a high coefficient between Marxism and narcissism.
I think that's absolutely true.
I'm just guesstimating because I have no degree in human behavior, but I do have 27 years of study of it in interacting with people and interviewing people, but that does not a degree make. The point, though, is that projection is one of the sort of road sign sins of narcissism, and I just see it so much in Marxism, I have to imagine there's a nexus. But to ask it, put it in a question format, what is the actual nexus between the pro-slavery sentiment and Marxism?
Well, you actually have some historical antecedents, because remember we established Adam Smith is an abolitionist, and really for the first part of the 19th century, there is a political alliance between the abolitionists and people who believe in economic freedom and free trade, classical liberalism. These things go hand in hand throughout the antebellum era. And what you get is on the eve of the Civil War, there's actually an opposing school of thought, and it's centered around this character by the name of George Fitzhugh. He's a pro-slavery activist in the United States. And he attacks critics of slavery, attacks the abolition movement as being wedded to capitalism. And he says the laws of supply and demand are going to undermine the order of our plantation system. So it's proto-socialist in the sense, because he's saying plantations are superior to these horrible factories in the north that exploit the laborers and take the fruits of their labor, whereas we compare that to the plantation of the south. We provide for our slaves. We give them food. We give them shelter. It's like perfect socialist utopia on this little farm that we've set up. And he says, we should cast Adam Smith into the fire because the true socialism of the world is the slave plantation system.
You know, I think Frederick Douglass might have had a counterpoint or two to that.
Indeed, he did. And Douglass is one of these many abolition thinkers. He goes over to Great Britain, and he tours the country with the free trade movement and says, I'm going to adapt your tactics and strategies. How did you abolish these restrictions on free commerce? And we're going to use them in the anti-slavery movement. So he actually has transatlantic supporters and friends that tend to be free market economists in that era.
Well, didn't capitalist abolitionists fight slavery?
That is absolutely the case. You see, there's another theorist in the early 19th century by the name of Thomas Carlyle. He's famous because he coins the term the dismal science of economics.
Right.
And we hear that still today. Well, what did he say the reason why economics was dismal? He said it's because the capitalists, the theorists of supply and demand, had allied themselves with the abolitionists and made a wedding of the two causes together, and these are causes that bring disorder and the chaos of the markets and the chaos of consumerism and everything he disliked, and they foist that on society instead of the structured order of this feudalist throwback that existed since the time of slavery.
Yeah, I got a three-word answer for him. Freedom is messy.
Exactly. That is exactly it.
But not to be the devil's advocate here, but wasn't the American Revolution fought in part to continue slavery?
Well, that's what Nicole Hannah-Jones claimed, and she really starts off her essay by making this. She gets into a lot of hot water because of it. And the assertion here is that there are some pro-slavery components on the American side. When she takes this little kernel of evidence that you have, especially in the southern colonies, people that were in favor of slavery that are also fighting for independence, and she elevates it and projects it onto the entire cause. The problem is the timeline doesn't work for her. So one of the major examples she uses is in late 1775, the colonial governor of Virginia, Lord Dunmore, offers freedom to slaves escaped from rebellious plantations if they join his army to reconquer the colony of Virginia. The problem is the revolution's already been underway for half a year at this point. Lexington and Concord, that's April 1775. George Washington already has an army in the field by the time these events occur. And this governor, Lord Dunmore, he's actually been pushed out of the colony. He's fled the capital of Williamsburg. He's running his government in absence from a ship out in the ocean. Really has nothing to go by on shore. So he attempts this last-ditch effort to enlist slaves to his cause. And Nicole Hannah-Jones says, aha, there's the proof. Well, the evidence here, not only does the timeline not work, Lord Dunmore himself is not an abolitionist. He was actually a slave owner. He had a large plantation on land that he's trying to get back to because he's been ousted as governor.
Well, he was against slavery before he was for it.
That's exactly it. So this all comes from ignorance of basic historical fact that is a pervasive part of her narrative.
Well, you know, I guess it's all part of the ignorance industrial complex.
Yes.
Was the Hannah-Jones depiction of the crown as an existential threat to American slavery in itself true, or was that another prevarication?
But it's nonsensical, because if you remember at this time in England, there's a very large pro-slavery faction of the British Parliament. And it comes from the slave trading families around Liverpool and Bristol and some of the port cities that were involved in the actual trafficking of human beings to the New World. And that they become a very viable political force from about the 1770s onward in resisting any attempt to bring about abolition in the New World. They're the things that Adam Smith is basically critiquing. They're saying they've infested the political system and made it impossible to abolish slavery because now you have a vested interest. These are the people that Wilberforce is later fighting against, so a couple decades later. And you see it's a real slog of a battle that starts in the 1770s, and it really doesn't culminate until the 1830s that they are finally able to beat this interest group out of the British crown. So the notion that the British crown is this mechanism about to push abolition onto the colonies is just nonsensical.
Well, a lot of it seems nonsensical. Unfortunately, the clock is a very egalitarian device, and it tells us we've come to the end. Where, one last time, give any website or how you want people to get the book or anything you want to say in the last 30 seconds.
Absolutely. So independent.org is the Independent Institute's website. Put most of my writings up there. Also information about how to find the book, The 1619 Project Myth. Again, brand new out in the stores as of last week, and you can get it at regular bookstores, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, all the usual suspects. So.
You're a joy and a delight because you answer the question that's asked, which is all a host can ask of a guest. And I really appreciate your time. And also your guy, Robert Aid, is one of the best publicists that I deal with. I'll just tell you that.
Outstanding. Happy to be here.
All right. And let's do it again sometime. Next time you have some interesting commentary or article, you have my email address. Send it to me directly and I'll book you in.
Happy to do so. Thanks again.
Have a blessed day. I got to let you go for the next guest. All right?
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that clears the deck. And AM 1030 KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, the voice. Stay tuned for America Armed and Free. And we have a treat coming up for you, Dominic from Max Level EDC, about flashlights and multi-tools. And we're going to geek out on gadgetry.